So if you read my speech, and many people have done it, and I've seen it both in the papers and in the media, on television, it's been analyzed, and people thought that what I said was totally appropriate. And if you look at what other people have said, politicians at a high level, about the riots during the summer, the horrible riots in Portland and Seattle and various other places, that was a real problem, what they said. But they've analyzed my speech and my words and my final paragraph, my final sentence, and everybody to the T thought it was totally appropriate.
President Trump speaking at Andrews Air Force Base this morning before taking off for a rally in Texas. It's unclear who the president was talking about who approved of his comments at that rally on Wednesday that turned deadly with an insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Democratic Representative Norma Torres of the Inland Empire described what her Wednesday was like.
We crawled across the entire length of that balcony. I was in the last group to be evacuated. We ran down the halls, stairs, near a mob that was being held on the ground at gunpoint. I sheltered for 4 to 5 hours in a room that was packed shoulder to shoulder with people. Adding more trauma to the riot we had just survived were several Republican colleagues refusing to wear a mask.
That's Democratic Congresswoman Norma Torres of the Inland Empire speaking on an online House committee meeting, the Rules Committee, that was meeting today in advance of the congressional action expected this afternoon. As you just heard on NPR News, the House expected to vote on a resolution asking Vice President Pence to take power from President Trump under the 25th Amendment. I'm Larry Mantle. It's good to have you with us on Air Talk today. We should mention the three Democratic members of the House have tested positive for COVID-19 since Wednesday when they were packed together in that room. We don't definitively know that it was that event that caused them to contract COVID-19, but that certainly is the sentiment among many members of Congress, that without significant masking by many members of the Congress, that put their colleagues at risk of COVID-19. We're going to have the very latest on what's going on with the House of Representatives, the president's defense as well. With us is Siobhan Hughes, congressional reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Siobhan, thank you very much for being with us. I know the president made these comments just about 2 hours ago. They're on the tarmac at Andrews. Has there been any response yet to what the president said in defending himself over the comments?
Well, right now, the locus of activity is the House Rules Committee meeting that you just described Norma Torres as speaking in. And there are fireworks going on in that committee room where if people are not directly responding to the president because they are focused on the task at hand, they would surely be outraged over the sentiment, at least if you are a Democrat. Democrats feel the remarks were incendiary, and there is really just a very big personal tension building in that committee room right now over the efforts by Republican Judiciary Committee official Jim Jordan trying to defend him.
And have there been any Republicans in that meeting that have come out favoring invoking the 25th Amendment or in favor of impeaching the president again?
I have not seen Republicans come out and speak in favor of either the 25th Amendment or proceeding with another impeachment. Part of the party's message has been the need for unity and division. And their case is that it is divisive at this moment to go ahead with an impeachment proceeding. Also that Democrats are being a little bit unfair because they point out that in 2017, it was Democrats who were challenging the Electoral College votes in some states that Mr. Trump had won. And so that's the line of defense from Republicans there.
All right. We're talking with Siobhan Hughes, congressional reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Let's just quickly go over the timeline. I want to remind our listeners that this afternoon at 3, we'll have live NPR coverage of the House move to invoke the 25th Amendment. Tomorrow morning, beginning at 6 o'clock our time, we'll begin with NPR's live coverage of the beginning of the impeachment proceedings in the House of Representatives. But Siobhan, there's no expectation among members of the House that Vice President Pence is going to comply with the 25th Amendment request, is there?
There's no expectation of that. In fact, he kept Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer on hold for 20 minutes, not taking their call when they called him to get him to intervene.
All right. If you have questions about what's going on with the House of Representatives, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also want to talk about the experiences of the lawmakers, which Norma Torres described in very poignant way. I mean, you hear how personal this is for members of the House of Representatives who went through this, not knowing what sort of harm this was going to cause, not just on their chambers, but on themselves individually. What's your sense to the degree that, particularly for Democrats, that this has become a very personal issue for them?
There is no overstating how personal this has become. These are no longer simply lawmakers observing some type of impeachable offense at a distance. These people consider themselves to be witnesses and victims. And the animosity between Republicans and Democrats, which was already there, has gotten to the point that I don't think it could get worse. You heard Adam Schiff today saying that he has nothing but contempt, for example, for Kevin McCarthy for allowing President Trump's behavior to continue to go on to turn into something that, in Democrats' view, led to violence.
Let's talk, Siobhan, about what's going on in the effort to bring to justice the people who attacked the Capitol. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer is calling on the FBI to add anyone identified breaching the Capitol to the federal no-fly list. What sort of progress is the FBI making in interviewing and arresting people who perpetrated the insurrection?
Well, right now, lawmakers are learning a little bit more about that because there is a briefing for some House committee chair people with officials from the FBI and the Justice Department. So the extent of their success is not entirely clear. We're hoping to get some sort of readout from lawmakers later on today once that wraps up.
All right. We're talking with Siobhan Hughes, congressional reporter for The Wall Street Journal. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. A little bit later, we'll talk in more detail about security efforts at the U.S. Capitol ahead of next Wednesday's inauguration of President-elect Biden. But Siobhan, what have you learned about the extent to which people will have access to the Capitol for that ceremony?
Well, there are already major new restrictions in place ever since last Wednesday's attack. What had been small little barriers have become large barricades. National Guard troops are marching in, and it's just going to be a lot tighter and a lot more restricted than what we are used to on that Hill. Already, because of coronavirus, attendance was going to be lighter. Members of Congress who were attending were limited to just one guest, but now things have gotten even tighter.
And we have the FBI alert that all 50 state capitals should be prepared for the potential for armed individuals to show up in support of the president and to potentially commit violent acts. To what extent do we know, Siobhan, is the FBI coordinating with law enforcement in all the states in the capital cities?
So I don't know to what extent the FBI is coordinating with everyone in the capital cities. You can tell from the alert that there is at least some high-level effort, but these are bureaucracies we're dealing with. The degree to which coordination can run smoothly is always certainly under a bit of a question mark.
All right. And finally, I wanted to ask you about the death of Sheldon Adelson, the billionaire donor to the GOP, strong supporter of Israel and support of it in the U.S. Congress. Adelson, who developed the Old Sands Hotel property as the Venetian and the Palazzo, he has died at the age of 87. What is going to be the effect on the Republican Party and specifically candidates who received hundreds of millions of dollars collectively in recent years?
You have hit the nail on the head. The primary effect for Republicans is the potential for a loss of a major part of their financial base. Sheldon Adelson was someone who the party or individual candidates could call on if they were in need. It saved the trouble of having to go about assembling money from small individual donors or even moderate-sized donors. So I don't think there is a way to overstate the degree of this loss for the Republican Party.
I guess one question will be if his widow Miriam steps into that role, because obviously the wealth, the family wealth continues. Siobhan, thank you so much. I appreciate your being with us.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you. Siobhan Hughes, congressional reporter for The Wall Street Journal with us. Also joining us, professor of American political institutions at Claremont McKenna College, George Thomas. Professor Thomas, so good to have you with us again.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So give us a sense of what you're looking for with the 25th Amendment resolution and the impeachment proceedings starting early tomorrow morning.
Well, I mean, the 25th Amendment really seems to be an attempt to pressure Pence and Republicans in the administration to take responsibility for Trump's actions over the last several days. I mean, as was reported, it seems to be going nowhere, but they seem to...
George, I'm sorry to interrupt. Chuck Schumer is speaking live right now in New York City.
...who breach the U.S. Capitol fall under the definition of threats to the homeland and should be immediately added to the TSA no-fly list. We are calling on the authorities, the FBI, the TSA, any of those who are inside the Capitol should be placed on the no-fly list and not be allowed to fly, because
he's just waiting for the siren to end. There's no immediate emergency.
Just wait till he goes. Any of those who are inside the Capitol should not be able to fly and should be placed on the no-fly list. We are calling on the authorities, FBI, TSA, Department of Homeland Security, to put them on the no-fly list immediately. Amidst the continued threat of future violence online, the federal government's own concerns, I spoke to Director Ray about this twice in the last few days, we cannot allow these same insurrectionists to get on a plane and cause more violence and more damage. These individuals are a threat to the homeland as defined by the law. The law allows this. And they should be placed on the no-fly list. Look, the attack on our Capitol remains under active investigation. The situation has many concerned about the possibility of another attack or attacks, and rightfully so. I'm continuing to be briefed on an almost daily basis, as recently as last night, by law enforcement. Ask them what their threat assessments are. Two, make sure they're going after every person who was inside that building. And three, to do everything they can to prevent any future attacks like the one that occurred in the Capitol. So, if these insurrectionists are not prosecuted to the full extent of the law, their pledges to disrupt and incite further violence could occur again. The law says that acts of terror, that like those perpetrated by the people who unlawfully and violently breached the Capitol, must be considered threats to the homeland. Once you're considered a threat to the homeland, you should and must be placed on the no-fly list.
Listening to Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York with the sounds of the city, New York City, in the background as he spoke, calling for all of the rioters at the U.S. Capitol to be placed on the TSA no-fly list under the definition of being threats to the homeland. George Thomas, Claremont McKenna College, Professor of American Political Institutions. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to hear what the senator had to say there. First, your thoughts on his comments, and then we'll get back to your analysis of the House.
Oh, no problem on the interruption, of course. But his comments are really just that the law enforcement needs to take this incredibly seriously. This was no ordinary event. Nothing like this has ever happened in American history. And if anything, it's odd that we're kind of responding to this slowly. To me, I mean, we haven't yet taken in what's really just occurred.
All right. And so with the House, let's get back to what you're going to be looking for most closely with this afternoon's and tomorrow's early morning proceedings.
Yeah, I think the 25th Amendment, which was really, meant for other purposes, essentially, in the wake of President Kennedy's assassination, to give a structure to the government if events like that occur. There's Section 4, which would allow the vice president and a majority of cabinet members, if they invoked it, to remove immediately presidential authority from President Trump, and then it would get contested in the House. The House seems to be wanting to pressure Pence and Republicans to, at least consider this avenue. That seems to me a non-starter, and that Pence has been very clear that even given recent events, he's not going to do that. And so then articles of impeachment, there's one right now. There are likely to be two from what's being reported by the time it hits the Senate floor, the House floor tomorrow morning. Then we'll see a debate on impeachment in the House, around largely the events of 1-6.
Well, and what's the point of doing this resolution on the 25th Amendment if everybody knows that's not going to happen?
I think that's an excellent question. And, I don't have a good answer. I think what's really occurring is that at least Democrats in the Congress are wanting to use all the constitutional levers possible. The 25th Amendment, there's even talk that we might want to get into of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which prohibits those who engage in seditious behavior from holding office. And then impeachment is the obvious lever of constitutional power here. But so the Congress is really thinking, what are all of the things we can do to remove what they view as an immediate threat in President Trump from office in his remaining week? And so the 25th Amendment is being invoked along those lines. What's unclear is why Congress didn't simply act more quickly. The impeachment in the Constitution is a fairly sparse process and gives the Congress tremendous leeway in how it can unfold. And in normal circumstances, I think we think this has to be kind of a long and drawn out process, but it's not at all clear that that's so, that the impeachment could be could move very quickly. So you could have had articles of impeachment voted out of the House and put to the Senate, and there are even some procedural ways to get the Senate to, get out of recess. And all of those avenues, interestingly, aren't being explored.
George, I wonder also if there's a political dynamic here. They're wanting to put the onus on the Republican members of the administration to take responsibility for Trump's behavior and his language. This is a way to do that. And also, if Mike Pence is going to be one of the stronger Republican candidates in 4 years for the presidency, they'll be able to cite that the 25th resolution passed and that he was not willing to invoke it.
I agree with all of that. I think that that's all right. But I think that's being a little political in the midst of.
Yeah, it's a separate issue. Exactly.
Yeah.
We're talking with George Thomas, Claremont McKenna College, professor of American political institutions. Coming up, we'll be joined by the Georgetown Law visiting professor of law and former director of Georgetown's National Security Law Program, Emtia Johnson, joins us again. We'll continue talking about what's to come in the House of Representatives, and with Professor Johnson, we'll talk importantly about the types of security preparations being made in advance of inauguration Liberation Day next Wednesday. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Whenever I think of the Senate filibuster, I think of that great Frank Capra, Jimmy Stewart movie, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and the classic scene of his filibuster. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC, the KPECC app, and streaming at kpecc.org. We're talking about the House of Representatives convening at 3 o'clock this afternoon. You'll have live coverage right here from NPR. You'll hear the resolution, which is going to be voted on, attempting to get Vice President Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment to remove President Trump from power. The 25th saying that a president who's unable to carry out the duties of the office, to perform the duties of the presidency, could be replaced by the vice president. That's not expected to convince Vice President Pence to invoke the 25th. Tomorrow morning, 6 o'clock our time, NPR live coverage of the impeachment proceeding in the House against President Trump. Joining us now is Emtia Johnson of Georgetown Law. She served in the Obama administration as Assistant Secretary for Legislative Affairs at the Department of Homeland Security and formerly directed Georgetown's National Security Law Program. Professor Johnson, thank you for being with us again. Give us a sense of the kinds of security protocols that are being worked on now.
Well, thank you for having me. Yes, we are. I'm here in the DC area. And so what has been invoked is a statute that authorizes or creates what's called national special security events. And the significance of that is that it gives DHS, specifically the Secret Service, the lead for coordinating and planning and implementing security for certain designated events. And so the inauguration is one of those types of events that are listed in the statute. It allows the Secret Service to bring in the resources of federal, state, and local law enforcement. And so as the reporter Siobhan Hughes just stated, you know, that I just came back from Georgetown Law Center and it's very visible. It's visible that it kicked in. Today was the first day. And so you have barricades up, you have layered forces up, is a very, very deep metropolitan police presence. And so it's that type of security that will be in place from now until the inauguration.
The FBI apparently had warned in a memo that there was going to be war outside the U.S. Capitol last Wednesday, and yet the Capitol Police were clearly way under-equipped and under-resourced overall to hold off the rioters as they attacked the Capitol building. How could that sort of disconnect take place?
That, you know, that's the million-dollar question, and that's what Congress will be investigating. How could it be? When you all interviewed me a couple of days ago, I raised that question. I said, one, the joint session of Congress should have been designated an NSSE, which then would have kicked in all of this, like I said, multi-layered law enforcement planning and coordination. The most important thing that comes out of NSSE is that you have this unified threat picture. So everyone is operating off of the same information. So the fact that the FBI sent the Capitol Police an alert and the Capitol Police did not seem to have responded to it is very troubling and concerning. Certainly the outgoing chief of Capitol Police said that he had requested assistance and that those requests were rebuffed by the Senate and House Sergeant in Arms. Of course, all three of those persons have since resigned.
It's just almost inconceivable how this ended up happening. But what I've heard, Professor, is that thousands of National Guard troops will be there at the Capitol for the inauguration and prepared there. So Do you have concerns about whether there's going to be sufficient law enforcement presence there?
Well, you always have concerns as a national security person.
You live with concerns every day. Yes.
Yeah. But to the extent that everyone is at a heightened level of security and awareness, I believe that the federal law enforcement elements will ensure that there is more than adequate security forces there. That the last thing that they want to see is a repeat of what has occurred. And the alerts are going out. Everyone is fully apprised that the groups that tried to stage the attempted coup last Wednesday, you know, are vowing to return and to be in return and be more heavily armed. And so everyone knows that there's thought and attempts to try to disrupt this inauguration next week.
We're talking with Georgetown Law visiting professor Emtia Johnson, former director of Georgetown's National Security Law Program and a member of the Obama administration at the Department of Homeland Security up until just a few years ago. Professor Johnson, I also wonder about the no-fly list process. We just heard Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer say that all of the individuals who breached security and attacked the U.S. Capitol should be placed on the no-fly list. Is that a high bar to cross?
Not necessarily. And again, this is another one of those post 9/11 statutes. I think Senator Schumer referred to it. There is a process. They would be designated and they could be placed on that no-fly list. Generally, you know, it's been applied to foreign terrorist threats, but to the extent that this definitely could fall under the definition of domestic terrorism, as Senator Schumer stated in his remarks, you know, that this was absolutely a threat to the homeland. It was not only a threat to the homeland, it was a threat to our constitutionally created system of government. And there was a direct threat to the elected leadership. We must never lose sight of the fact that the second, third, and fourth persons in the order of succession were in the Capitol at the time that this insurrectionist mob, broke in. And if they had been a determined enemy and came in with guns a-blazing, they could have decapitated both the legislative and part of the executive leadership of this country. So yeah, they if they can be identified by the center that does this, they most definitely, I agree with Senator Schumer, put them on the no-fly list. They need to be put on every type of list that's possible.
Thank you so much, Professor Johnson. Appreciate your being with us again today on Air Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Let me share a listener comment from Bill in the San Gabriel Valley. To the GOP, you were calling for unity. Here's another POV I saw. If the Capitol rioters had been BLM egged on by the squad, and then the Democrats called for unity, what would the GOP think? Would they agree to it? Of course not. They will cite law and order and that the insurrectionists should be punished. So in this GOP call for unity, Bill writes, where is the law and order they keep espousing? We go back to CMC, Professor of American Political Institutions, George Thomas. Your thoughts on Bill's posting on the Air Talk page?
Yeah, I mean it's a really fair question, and I mean, the different treatment to the those who stormed the Capitol. I think insurrectionists or seditionists is a proper term to those who attacked Congress. Compared to the Black Lives Matter protests is rather extraordinary. And, you know, the one thing that jumps out rather obviously is that those, attacking Congress were overwhelmingly white, unlike the Black Lives Matter protesters this summer. I mean, there's no question symbolically that's exactly what it looks like. We'll know more as, you know, we understand the reasons why security was so weak at the Capitol. But certainly on its face, that's just a fair question. And it's really disingenuous for Republicans after the president's speech, after they've trafficked in, you know, or looked the other way with regard to fraudulent claims about election fraud for nearly 2 months, to suddenly cry for unity. And to cry for unity after the president's statements this morning is even more disingenuous.
What do you think about elected office holders being at the event outside the Capitol building? Norman Lakewood posts on the page, did you see there was a local councilwoman, an Orange County school board member there? Outrageous, she says. What do you think about elected officials attending that event? Should that disqualify them for holding their office?
You know, that's one of those things that really could get very case specific, I would say. You know, what exactly? Because, I mean, when you look at the event, what's extraordinary is that there's just this cluster of people, and some of them, you know, are, you know, attending in a rally and they're engaged in it. And I don't know that they truly know what's unfolding. Others are, you know, are clearly armed and prepared and, you know, and prepared for violence at a very serious level. And, you know, so that it contains both of those groups. And so I think that's going to be where it has to come down to individual cases. You know, we're going to have to look at the people involved. What did they know? What were they doing? And then, you know, then you have to turn to the leaders. There's no question that many of the leaders were rhetorically inciting violence. You know, it's irresponsible to then say, oh, I'm surprised that they actually engaged in this.
According to City News Service, LAPD Chief Michael Moore says his department will order any personnel who traveled to Washington, D.C. at the time of the insurrection to participate in interviews with the FBI, even if the LAPD personnel didn't participate in illegal activity themselves. Chief Moore says they may be able to help the FBI identify people who did commit crimes at the U.S. Capitol, that being reported by City News Service of Los Angeles. Professor, thank you so much for joining us again. We'll look forward to talking with you again soon.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
He's professor of American political institutions at Claremont McKenna College, George Thomas, joining us on Air Talk. Coming up, we'll talk about the out-migration from California. The pandemic has only fueled greater out-migration. The cost of living in California, one of the biggest reasons why, but there are others. I want to hear from you. If you're contemplating leaving the state, what are the reasons that are behind that? If you have friends or family members who have left, what led them to go elsewhere and where did they relocate? 866-893-KPECC. I want to hear from you when we come back from the break. We're talking about people leaving California. Where are they going? And what's the prompt for the leaving? 866-893-5722. Back in 90 seconds.